Welcome, and thank you for standing by. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the call over to Lauren Gaseous. You may begin.
Thank you so much. Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm Lauren Gaseous with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. Today's update will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question-and-answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers are going to be following can be downloaded at https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings, plural. With that, I will introduce today's speakers. Our first presenter is Ira Sanchez-Lugo, climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the May U.S. and Global Climate Report and the Drought Monitor. Our second presenter today is Andy Ashley, Deputy Director of the Watershed Division at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers with the Mississippi River Valley Division. He'll be providing an overview of the impacts of recent weather across the U.S. on infrastructure around the Mississippi River Valley. And our third presenter today is Matthew Rosenkrantz, meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Nino-La Nina update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the next 3 months. Our first speaker will be Ira from NOAA.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Let's go ahead and move to slide two, please. Here we're going to be talking about the global temperature during May 2019. You can see May 2019 was characterized by warmer than average conditions across much of the global land and ocean surface temperatures. Record warm May temperatures were present across parts of the southern half of Africa, western Indian Ocean, New Zealand, and its surrounding ocean, among other areas. And there were some areas that did experience cooler than average conditions, and these were a large portion of the contiguous U.S. and central and southeastern Canada, as well as across much of Europe, central and southern Asia, and parts of the southern oceans and the North Atlantic Ocean. Averaged as a whole, the global land and ocean temperature for May was 1.53 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. This resulted in the fourth warmest May since global records began in 1880. That's a total of 140 years of data. The last 5 years, 2015 through 2019, have been the five warmest Mays on record, with May 2016 the warmest. Looking at just the global land-only temperature, it was the eighth highest on record at 2.09 degrees Fahrenheit above average. And the global ocean-only temperature for the month tied with 2015 as the second highest May temperature on record, trailing behind 2016. Moving to slide three now, very briefly. The first 5 months of the year for the global land and ocean temperature were warmer than average. Overall, this was the third highest January through May temperature on record, trailing behind 2016 and 2017. We expect that the 2019 will end among the 10 warmest years on record, and very likely to end among the five warmest years since records began in 1880. Moving now to slide number four, zooming into the contiguous U.S. May for the U.S. can be described as cold across much of the U.S. and very wet. Overall, the nation had a cooler-than-average May at 0.7 degrees Fahrenheit below average. This was the coolest May for the contiguous U.S. since 2011. Five states had a May temperature that ranked among the 10 coldest Mays on record. This includes Arizona, Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Utah. However, no state was record cold for May. There were some areas that did experience above-average conditions, and these were limited to much of the Mid-Atlantic, the Southeast, as well as parts of the Northwest. Overall, there were 10 states that had a May temperature that ranked among the 10 warmest Mays on record, and Florida had its warmest May, was the, actually the only state that had a record warm May, while North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia had their second warmest May on record. In terms of precipitation, again, it was pretty much wet across much of the contiguous U.S., with pockets of drier than average conditions across parts of the southeast and the northern tier. Averaged as a whole, May was the second wettest May on record, as well as the second wettest month of all months on record. May 2015 was actually the wettest month on record at 4.44 inches for the nation. Near record to record precipitation was observed from the west coast through the central plains and into the Great Lakes, as well as parts of the northeast. And as you all know, flooding is an ongoing concern across the central U.S. The last 12 months have been so wet that it was the wettest 12-month period on record for any 12-month period, surpassing the previous record that was only set last month, May 2018 through April 2019. The extreme wet conditions across the central U.S. have caused unprecedented impacts to the agricultural sector. Now moving to slide 5, the national temperature for spring 2019 was near average. The spatial pattern, I don't have the map here, but the spatial pattern was very similar to May, where warmer than average conditions were mainly present across the mid-Atlantic and the southeast, as well as parts of the northwest, while the rest of the contiguous U.S. had near to cooler than average conditions. There were 7 states that had spring temperatures that ranked among the 10 warmest springs on record. This included Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. And while South Dakota was the only state that had a spring temperature that ranked among the 10 coldest springs on record. It was actually the 9th coldest spring for South Dakota. However, again, no state had a record cold spring on record. Looking at Alaska, as you can see by the map, it was a very warm spring. The statewide temperature for Alaska was 8.6 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This surpassed the previous record that was set in 2016 by 0.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Looking at precipitation now, spring 2019 was the wettest spring since 1995 for the contiguous U.S., and it was the 6th wettest in the nation's 125-year record. Kansas had its wettest spring on record, with 6 additional states having a top 5 wet spring. Moving to my last slide. This is the most up-to-date U.S. drought monitor map. It was released this morning at 8:30. As you can see, the drought footprint is still small. It did increase slightly compared to April. That was less than 3% of the contiguous U.S. in drought, which as of today, it has increased to 4.1. There was some drought improvement across parts of the coastal plain of Georgia and South Carolina. However, some drought did deteriorate across parts of the northern North Dakota, as well as the Pacific Northwest. Outside of the contiguous U.S., drought continues to be present across parts of the southwest and south-central Puerto Rico, as well as in Hawaii, and we've seen that drought has been deteriorating across the Alaska Panhandle. One thing that I wanted to note is that this was Arizona had, for the first time, is drought-free in almost 10 years. Now moving. That's all I have for now, so I'll turn it over to Andy Ashley.
Thanks, Sarah. This is Andy Ashley with the Corps of Engineers out of our Mississippi Valley Division. The first slide here just kind of shows what we're doing with all this water and these wettest records that have been set here in the spring and winter that's been coming to us. So what are we as the Corps doing with that? This is the picture of the entire Mississippi River watershed. It covers 1.25 million square miles, which is about 40% of the United States. It's 31 states and 2 Canadian provinces, and that all funnels down into the lower Mississippi River and comes out below New Orleans. So we have to deal with all that water. Every flood is different. And so in this pie chart here, you see that typically on average, even though the Ohio River watershed represents a smaller portion of our overall greater watershed, we get 60% of our runoff that flows in the lower Mississippi comes from the Ohio River Valley. But every flood is different. This 2019 has been different. It's been just the opposite. the Ohio River has been running very low, which has really helped us manage all of this water. Instead, the Upper Miss has received a record amount of rainfall, as well as Missouri and the Arkansas as well. Each one of these subsegments, we work together with the National Weather Service. They have a river forecast center for each one of these regions, with the lower two, Arkansas and Red, combined. But we work together with them to manage forecasts and releases from our reservoirs to handle these projects. In terms of the Mississippi Valley itself, we operate six core districts along that stretch, along the Mississippi from St. Paul, Minnesota, all the way down to New Orleans, Louisiana. If you turn to slide 8, we'll show you just a kind of what's been going on the upper and middle Mississippi. We've been setting record flooding in Iowa, Illinois, Missouri. We set an all-time record this year at Rock Island, Illinois. That's in Davenport, Iowa. There was a overtopping there back in March in Davenport, as well down in Burlington. That record here in 29 surpassed the great 1993 flood. What you see on the bottom left here is a picture of Lock and Dam 20 in Canton, Missouri. And this I had this as a GIF that showed the river flowing here, but it's basically the water has gotten so high that it closed all of our locks and dams at a certain point, and some of those reopened since. But we've had to pull all of our gates out of the water and let this water pass. Here at this particular lock and dam, our lock tenders have been boating in to work since mid-March just to get there. And what they're doing is just running pumps to protect our outbuildings and structures from getting water inside the buildings. So they've been running pumps continuously there to keep our lock and dams ready for when they do reopen. The top picture shows you a difference between May and June of this year of the confluence of you kind of see the Missouri River kind of snaking in at the bottom. The upper Mississippi River is coming in to the left, and then the Illinois is just to the east of the Mississippi, all coming together just above St. Louis. And so you see the dramatic change between May and June of all this water that we're receiving. We measure our water in flow, which is a volume of water over time. So we measure that in cubic feet over seconds. And talking of record numbers here, we almost approached a million CFS at St. Louis. We got close to 950. And that was a combination of 450,000 CFS coming from the Missouri, along with 400,000 coming from the Upper Miss, and then 100 coming from the Illinois River, all coming down to set the second highest stage ever at St. Louis just a couple weeks ago. So that bottom right picture there, I was in the helicopter 2 weeks ago, and that's a picture of the Gateway Arch just 3 days before it set the second all-time record there, second only to 1993 flood in St. Louis. As we move to the next picture, I'm in the next slide, slide number 9. Just kind of want to focus in now on the lower Mississippi. As below St. Louis, the Ohio River system comes in at a place called Cairo, Illinois. And below Cairo to the Gulf of Mexico, the Corps operates a comprehensive flood protection system called the Mississippi River and Tributaries Project. And so it works together. It's a series of levees and backwater areas of protection and floodways to handle, make room for the river, all this water we're receiving. So here in particular is a picture of the Yazoo River Basin, which is in the state of Mississippi. It's the Mississippi Delta. So this is in between Memphis, Tennessee, and Vicksburg, Mississippi, where we operate a backwater area. And a backwater area, typically, it's a levied area that during major floods protects that area, keeps it dry, so farms can stay dry and areas are protected. However, like I said at the beginning, every flood is different. In this case, a lot of this rain fell inside of this backwater area. And so, but the Mississippi River had gotten so high that we were unable to open any gates to release this water. And so right now there's over 500,000 acres of land that's inundated in this area. The whole Yazoo River Basin that could be evacuated right there, it's about the size of four Rhode Islands. It's 2.6 million acres. And right now almost a quarter of that is underwater. So you see pictures of flooding here in the Yazoo Basin that we're still dealing with and will be dealing with for quite a while. If we go to slide 10, my last slide just focuses more in the Louisiana area of where we're dealing with flooding. The water that I mentioned again that comes in at Cairo, so you've got the combined Ohio and Upper Miss and Missouri rivers coming in there. If you add all that water up, in 2019 ranks as the most water the most volume of water that we've ever gotten in a water year, ever. And so it's created quite a bit of work for us. Down below New Orleans, just above New Orleans, you see in this picture in the top left is a picture, a satellite picture. This is actually from 2008, just to show you what we're looking at here, where you see the city of New Orleans, and just to the west, you see it's the word spillway. That is the Bonnie Carey Spillway. It's a floodway we operate. When the flows get so high in the river, we divert water into Lake Pontchartrain to the north to prevent and protect water from entering into New Orleans. And so this is the first time ever that we've had to operate that spillway twice in 1 year. The first, we'd operated for 44 days earlier this year, and then currently it's still, we've had it open for 41 days as of today for this second opening. So this is the 14th time in history that we've had to open Bonnie Carey Spillway. You see also there in the bottom left, just pictures, and you just see how our levees are doing their job of protecting the system, but at the same time, how high the water is and how that barge is sitting to this community to the right here in the bottom left picture in Baton Rouge. We also have another major flood floodway called Morganza that diverts water from the main stem Mississippi River and sends it southwesterly towards another part of southern Louisiana to prevent the water from continuing down the main stem. We've only had to use that twice in the history of operations, and we came close this time. We made preparations anticipating because of all the additional rainfall that came down the Arkansas River, that all the rainfall in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Kansas areas went straight through the Arkansas River through Little Rock. And that again, talking in terms of flow, reached up to upwards of 550,000 CFS. So that combined with all the water that was coming down, we were anticipating having to operate that. However, as the water started to come into the main stem, it started to attenuate and kind of spread out a little bit. And so we never quite got to the trigger, thank goodness, where we had to operate Morganza. But there you see a picture of how close we came. But that's just kind of a real quick rundown of what we've been doing this year with these record-setting volumes of water. With that, I'll turn it over to Matt Rosenkranz with the Climate Prediction Center.
Good morning, everybody. This is Matthew Rosenkranz, Climate Prediction Center. So I'm going to talk about the latest sea surface temperature and El Nino southern oscillation conditions, and then also how that relates to the forecast for July and also July, August, September. The sea surface temperatures that we noticed across the central and equatorial Pacific, which is a major region that has a lot of forcings for changing the wind patterns over the Pacific and into the U.S. and North America. Those sea surface temperatures are above normal for most of the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. We have noticed at depth some increasing cooler waters right out near the dateline and also in the eastern Pacific right near the coast of South America. Some reduction in sea surface temperatures there. But in the core regions that we monitor for the for El Nino, those are still above normal. The latest Nino 3.4 value was 0.7 degrees Celsius, so that's still above normal and still greater in El Nino conditions. There's weak El Nino conditions. They are present. That's when we are between 0.5 and 1.0 degrees centigrade above normal, although there is shorter-term fluctuations that happen during the month of May into early June. They've kind of interrupted some of the connections between El Nino and the atmosphere because those fluctuations will happen within the course of a month. So they're fluctuations that happen within the longer-term El Nino pattern. We also do think that those shorter-term fluctuations have contributed to some of the changing where there's the cool water building at depths down at about 300 meters below the sea surface. So we think the short-term fluctuations have contributed to the building of that cooler water. And we would actually expect that to reverse in the next couple of weeks when we have the opposite phase of those fluctuations come through. The official name for those fluctuations is the Madden-Julian Oscillation. Going forward with the El Nino forecast, we do think that El Nino is likely to continue through the autumn of 2019. That's at about a 50 to 55% chance through autumn. Shorter term, through the summer, there's a 60% chance of El Nino continuing through the end of the Northern Hemisphere summer. If we go to slide 12, the monthly forecast for July. The monthly forecast for July has a lot of factors. In Alaska, the sea surface temperatures along the west coast and the southwest of Alaska are well above normal, as well as an El Nino pattern would support large-scale high pressure over a lot of Alaska, which would favor the above-normal temperatures, and that's what's in the forecast here. Sliding down to the western part of the U.S., basically from the Rockies to the west coast, we do favor above-normal temperatures, but it's only really a slight tilt. And that is mainly from the longer-term trend. When we look at the last 15 years of temperatures, what have those done relative to our longer 30-year climatology base period? The reason also there's a mitigating factor on the trends, so the trends would probably support higher probabilities, but there has been some wetness, as was talked about earlier, into the southwest U.S. and some of the higher terrain, and even up into Idaho. There's some snows on their forecast that happened recently, and there's some more forecast. So that recent precipitation can help to dampen some temperatures going into the warm season. Over the center part of the U.S., all of that moisture that has been talked about that fell, and that was talked about with the previous two presenters, would really favor below normal temperatures. All that moisture and all that water sitting on top of the earth really allows for the incoming sunlight energy to not be translated to actual temperatures, but it gets translated into evaporation. So that doesn't actually increase your temperatures as much. It can increase your humidity and make it feel a little stickier, but the actual measured temperature should be lower than if you didn't have all that water. And then that's in the July precipitation forecast. We do actually have a forecast for above normal precipitation in the center part of the country. And that's also related a lot to the likely patterns that are for July that are associated with ongoing El Niños, and also related to the fact that you have all of that moisture sitting on top of the surface of the earth, and you can just evaporate that much more off, and you can have a little bit more local thunderstorms, and it's called precipitation and moisture recycling. That's a known mechanism to drive more precipitation in the center part of the U.S. Going to slide 13, the July, August, September outlook. The July, August, September temperature probability, it is reflective of longer-term trends in Alaska, where those are actually the strongest in the U.S., favoring the above-normal sea surface temperatures. Even towards the end of September, you might get some ice edge coverage towards the north shore of Alaska, but ice right now is at its lowest levels on record, so we would expect that to come in later. That would be more of an October thing this year, so we're not expecting any impact from that September, so that would favor above normal temperatures. Western U.S., we do have above normal temperatures there, and the trends are able to take a lot longer. They're able to have a larger influence when you talk about a three-month period versus just a July. So we do have slightly higher probabilities for above normal temperatures in the western U.S. Those recent rains and recent precipitation in the spring have less of an impact when you start to look forward out in time. The center of the country is forecast at below normal temperatures and above normal precipitation again in a region kind of the below normal temperatures are really from the central plains up to the Great Lakes. That's really driven by El Nino. There's our LoVar composites. From past El Nino events show a cool streak that goes from the Great Lakes down to the central U.S. and even some into the southwest U.S. The precipitation forecast for July, August, September, we are favoring above normal precipitation from Idaho to Missouri, and that is really a factor that is associated with El Ninos. We are a northward extent of the monsoon in the western U.S., which is linked to the temperature patterns. If we have higher temperatures further to the northwest, that would draw the monsoonal moisture up into the western U.S. a little bit further, as well as the local precipitation and moisture recycling over the center part of the U.S. That's another factor in the seasonal outlook. If we move to slide 14, the drought outlook, with the above normal temperatures and only near normal precipitation forecast, or excuse me, climatological precipitation forecast for the western U.S. and along the northern boundary with Canada, U.S. Drought intensification and or development is likely in the Pacific Northwest and also in the northern Great Plains. We would also forecast some drought improvement across New Mexico in the southwest with the expected onset of the monsoon, and as well in the southeast U.S. as they really get to the core of their wet season. Where the drought was not as intense, we are forecasting some improvement there. The drought was most intense in the Carolinas, especially North Carolina, which had its largest precipitation deficits, so they may not get enough precipitation to remove their drought. Also, there's some signals from an El Nino that would slightly reduce precipitation in the Northeast and into the Mid-Atlantic, so the confidence in getting even seasonal amount of precipitation in the Mid-Atlantic is a little bit lower, so we didn't forecast drought improvement there. One area of note in the panhandle of Alaska, they are forecast to have their drought continue, and there's some with their, so there should be some of those ongoing water supply issues there affecting hydrologic power. They're not likely to get any relief in the next 3 months. And that's all I have, and I'll pass it back to Lauren Gacious.
Thanks, Matt. We'll now take to the questions from call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer your question if possible. And operator, if you would, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question and queue up for the first one. Thank you.
You're welcome. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And one moment for our first question. That will be coming from Doyle Rice. Your line is open, Doyle. You may ask your question.
Thanks for doing this. A question for Ahira, I believe it is. Just what the chances are that the global temperature for the entire year will be possibly the second or even the first warmest on record? I know you often plan it out or you often forecast it out for the entire year, and I know you said it would be 100% chance that it's among the 10 warmest. I just wondered what your chances are for second or first warmest.
Yeah, for first warmest, the chance was really small. It was less than 2% chance.
Okay.
And top two, I think it was less than 10%. We have a website. If you go to our global report, you can actually go to a supplemental page that we talk about that, and we have a graph that shows the percentages for the first through the fifth.
Oh, okay, and that's on the monthly report
page? Yes,
yeah.
But 95% confidence level is from second to fifth warmest on record for the year.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Just a reminder, press star 1 to ask a question. Our next question will come from Jason Stahl. Jason, your line is open. You may ask your question.
Hi, this is for either Ahira or Matthew. Just wondering, with the report that came out today with May and January through May, like how do those final numbers compare to what your predictions were? And also, how do your predictions in the past and moving forward for the next season compare to what the Farmers' Almanac has said?
So this is Matthew. I can take that question.
Okay.
For the January, February, March forecast, there was a lot more cold in the center part of the U.S. forecast than what we had. The cold was more observed than what we forecast. So the observations were a lot colder than what we had forecast for January, February, March. Even through March, April, May, there was some cold from the below normal temperatures from the Pacific Northwest all the way through the center part of the country. And then in the southeast U.S. was above normal. We had a lot of the above normal temperatures forecasted for the eastern U.S., but we did not have the forecast of the below normal temperatures out in the Pacific Northwest and into the southwest U.S. We had equal chances forecast for the center part of the U.S. So the March, April, May forecast ended up with a score of minus 0.86, and so it was slightly below climatology forecast. As far as the other forecasts, we don't really comment on other people's forecasts, so I don't really have an answer for that one.
Okay. Thank you.
And at this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Okay. Thank you so much. Since it sounds like we have no further questions anymore, and again, I just wanted to say thank you to our speakers for participating with us today and also our call participants for dialing in and joining us. With that, I will wrap up today's call.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.